begin after six taps. One, two, three, four, five, six.
All right, hello, listeners. Welcome back to FlixWise. I'm your host, Royal Saint Fromage, Lady P. No relation to Master P. It's been a minute since we've released a podcast, and even longer since I've posted an episode. But I've missed you all so, so much, and many thanks to Martin Kessler for holding it down. Well, I've been off engaging in scholarly pursuits. Sure. Speaking of scholarly pursuits, today's guests are also fellow UW-Madison film graduate students. First up, we have a man whose shake is worth $5 and then some.
I don't even know if that's a good thing or bad thing.
It's a great thing.
Okay.
We have returning guest, Mr. Tim Braden. Welcome back, Tim.
Thank you. Always a pleasure to be here.
Indeed, indeed. And twisting her way up to the mic for her FlixWise debut is Lulu cosplayer, Miss Megan Boyd.
Hey, how's it going?
Hi, Megan. Okay, so Megan, you primarily study silent era film comedians, right?
Yes.
So it seemed like a very natural fit to have you
talk about Pulp Fiction.
Talk about this incredibly important 90s male film.
Exactly. The most 1990s movie and the most like boy movie of all time.
Well, you're keeping me up to date with the talkies.
Exactly. okay, and then on today's show, in case the opening clues didn't tip you off, we're going to talk about the 127th film on the Sight and Sound Critics Poll. It is Quentin Tarantino's 1994 landmark film, Pulp Fiction. Mr. Tarantino has a new movie out in theaters, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, and it is also the 25th anniversary of Pulp Fiction's release, so it seemed like a good time to take another look at this film bro favorite and see if it is worthy of all of its accolades, or perhaps to determine if a quarter-life crisis is imminent. And more importantly, we'll apply our keen academic training and analytical eyes to tease out the historical and sociopolitical implications of whatever the hell is happening with John Travolta's hair. Grease is the word, indeed. all right. So you both ready to cue the Dick Dale?
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
Let's do it. All right. Okay, so brief summary. Okay, Pulp Fiction is a story of two hitmen, Vincent and Jules, played by John Travolta and Samuel L. Jackson, respectively, who, while on their way home from murdering a room full of young drug dealers and collecting the Kiss Me Deadly briefcase at the behest of their boss, Marcellus Wallace, played by Ving Rhames, accidentally shoot one of their associates in the face and need to clean up the mess before anyone takes notice. Once that task is completed, Vincent and Jules stop at a nearby Greasy Spoon for breakfast, where Jules gives a talking to a young couple who are attempting to hold up said Greasy Spoon. That evening, Vincent is charged with taking Marcellus Wallace's wife, Mia, played by Uma Thurman, out on the town. She opts for a 1950s-style diner and insists that she and Vincent compete in a twist contest. Vincent then attempts to deposit Mia safely back at her house, but before he can leave, Mia gets into Vincent's heroin stash and overdoses. Vincent frantically takes the unconscious Mia to his drug dealer's residence, and they all fumble around to figure out what to do, until Vincent works up the nerve to plunge an adrenaline shot into Mia's heart. While all this is going down, an aging boxer named Butch, played by Bruce Willis, who is also under the employ of Mr. Wallace, has just refused to throw a fight that he was instructed to lose. Wallace is furious and puts a hit out on Butch. The next morning, when Butch returns to his apartment, he finds Vincent in his bathroom and shoots him dead. Then he and Wallace have a chance encounter on the street and nearly kill each other, but a couple of hillbillies stop them and take them prisoner in a pawn shop basement. The hillbillies begin raping Wallace while Butch makes his escape. However, instead of making a run for it, he goes back to rescue Wallace, saving both their lives. As thanks, Wallace decides to spare Butch and lets him run away with his teenage girlfriend. And that's just about the gist of it. Except scrambled and shaken a few times.
Right. So technically what you've just offered is not a plot synopsis. It's a story synopsis because, as we all know, plot is what happens in the order that it happens in the movie.
There you go.
And Pulp Fiction is not that.
That is true. Quite true. In fact, I believe we're going to get into the difference between plot and story in just a few minutes. Right. I think that's going to be a major element of this discussion. If I had to guess, if I had a little crystal ball. But, okay, so there is no doubt that part of the appeal of this film is reassembling its jumbled narrative and fractured timeline. But there's also an argument to be made that if you're watching for the plot, you're doing it wrong. The film style, including its use of music and camera movement, as well as its funny and sometimes poignant dialogue, are what many cite as its crowning achievements. Well, that and all the good old-fashioned bloodshed. When this film first arrived on the scene in the mid-1990s, it made an enormous critical splash, winning many prestigious awards, including the Palme d'Or at Cannes and an Academy Award for Best Original Screenplay. The film has only accumulated more legions of fans as well as imitators in the intervening years, but there remains only one, Pulp Fiction. The question for us today is, does the film still inspire the same fervor in the year of our Lord 2019? And perhaps more challenging, what can one possibly say about this film that hasn't already been said and enthused over by overeager film students for the past two decades? But let's see what we can come up with. Okay. So, Tim, let's start with you.
Yes. Well. So the questions are, does it still inspire fervor and is there anything left to say? If my answers are no and nothing, can I leave?
And good night, everyone. This has been fun.
No, my thing with Pulp Fiction, which is a movie I still enjoy watching, I actually it was better than I hoped it would be, revisiting it for the first time in many, many years. It's one of the quintessential victims of its own success, really, because it did all of this stuff that was so new in 1994, like taking a mainstream genre film, because it's basically a gangster picture, right, of a sort that we've been making for, 50, 60 years, longer than that even. But it's fragmenting it and turning it into this weird sort of postmodern, like, trifle almost. Like, it's just all over the place. There's like, just grab a bit of it and you're going to get something different than if you wait 5 minutes and grab a different bit. And in 1994, this is not unprecedented, but certainly unprecedented in this kind of teenagers going out to watch a movie sphere. Like, they have not encountered this kind of story structure. So Pulp Fiction comes out, inspires a number of imitators that I don't even know how you'd go about quantifying. So 25 years later, it really feels old hat because so many films have done the same thing since. And I mean, yeah, this is the film that did it first, and that counts for something. But at the same time, I feel like it's become cozy and familiar, which are the two specific things that this should not be. It should feel transgressive, radical, dangerous, and now it's none of those things.
Mm. Yeah. I'm going to echo that sentiment, but first I want to go to Megan because, as I mentioned, this is maybe just a teeny bit out of your normal wheelhouse, right?
Yeah.
Just a little bit. I mean, you're a film student, so surely you've encountered Tarantino
talkies
before.
Yes.
Yeah, talkies. And also people, big fans of Tarantino. You're a woman out in the world.
Oh,
surely.
Yeah.
you've had rendezvous with those who like to talk about Tarantino, even if he may not be your exact cup of tea, but maybe he is. So I want the reason we asked you on this show is because, like, it was a process. We were thinking about, like, who do we know who might be able to offer an interesting perspective on this filmmaker, because it does feel like everything has already been said about him and what's new. So we're hoping you might offer a fresh take.
So take the innocent grandma who's still watching 1920 cinema and see, what does she make of this postmodern phenomenon? No, I mean, I will say I am going to have a different perspective in the sense that this actually was, watching with you two, was the first time that I had ever seen this film from start to finish. I had obviously seen particular scenes, such as the scene with Samuel L. Jackson giving his famous Bible quotation. I had obviously seen, and I had actually used some clips for teaching dark comedy to my students. So I had encountered the film, seen the Vincent Vega and Mia Wallace storyline. But no, I had never made it farther than that. And I do think that part of my reluctance to actually see it did come from the masculine fanboy culture that has grown around it, even though, of course, I'm sure that there are female audience members that love that film just as much as you know, men who belong to film programs or male film fans. But for some reason, and it would be interesting to dissect this more during the podcast, for some reason there does seem to have been this particularly masculine, aggressive sort of idolization of this film that's kind of taken it to a place where it's hard for someone like me to not immediately balk at that and shy away from it. And actually, I found it interesting, like, I was looking up some of the reception of the film, and Stanley Kaufman of The New Republic said that, quote, the way that the film had been so widely ravened up and drooled over verges on the disgusting. And that is really how I was going into this film, you know, with that negative association right away, and particularly from not just my male students. I don't think that they use the film in a negative context. They often are just admiring the stylistic skill, but often on dates I would go on, you encounter a certain type of male who uses their knowledge of Tarantino to try to assert their superior knowledge of film aesthetics over you as a female film graduate student. And it is particularly frustrating. And as we go through particular qualities of the film, I would be happy to touch on all of the various ways that that film would come up over the course of those dating conversations, because there are many, many elements that they would utilize to assert that superior knowledge.
Can't wait.
It was there. But I will say, watching it as just a quick initial response, I didn't have the negative reaction to it that I thought I was going to have. I do think that it is a very it was a fun film to watch. I did enjoy it. I did think that the dialogue was surprisingly clever. I think, obviously, I am not a Tarantino expert, and others probably know that he's more known for his dialogue than I did. I had seen more recent films of him and thought of him as a spectacle director, or as with the action and the violence. I actually didn't think of him as being particularly strong in terms of dialogue and screenplay, but I was shocked at how talky the film was. It really was a lot of dialogue as opposed to these kind of violent set pieces. So
it's surprising that you liked it.
Well, hey, silent films had intertitles. Lots of verbal humor through intertitles. No, I actually do tend to prefer films that are a little more talky or feeling like we're getting to know the characters as opposed to just these kind of action set pieces. So I did enjoy that. There were definitely aspects and criticisms that I think were upheld, and I'll be happy to talk about those, because there is a certain postmodern vacuousness and certain aspects of masculine bro culture that I do think were established and still upheld by my viewing of the film.
Yeah, I guess I'll echo both of your reactions. When I first saw it, I was completely blown away. But I think I was also about 15 years old when I saw it. So watching it now as an adult is a very, I mean, you know, it's different. It still has that same energy, and it's still kind of, I have a nostalgic fondness for it, and probably always will. But I will say that the decade plus that it has now been in my life, I mean, some of that kind of fondness has given way to frustration, because Tarantino is not blameless in this, but his fans are fervent and very, I guess it's not so much like their enthusiasm for Tarantino that's the problem. It's like
It's the elements that they are enthusiastic for.
Yeah,
right.
Exactly.
Maybe even misreading at times.
Perhaps, yeah.
I mean, I think that's generous to Tarantino. I don't think he does anything to forestall those misreadings, like, whatsoever.
True.
Yeah.
Well, and some of his own comments about the film, like, I was reading interviews where he was saying that he wanted to adopt the multi-story structure because films didn't do that. He'd only seen it in novels. And I'm thinking, and so he is essentially taking credit for being the first film director to attempt this multi-story structure. It's like, I think Joseph L. Mankiewicz would have something to say
sure.
about this. And I actually think that he does this better in A Letter to Three Wives or in here, stories here. Where sure. they have that same tri-story structure, but more carefully integrated mm-hmm. or more seamless. So suck on that, Tarantino.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. So, but I do think some of his own commentary does contribute to this, you know, packaging of himself and yeah. his own innovations.
Sure, sure. Well, okay, so let's talk about some of our encounters with Tarantino fanboys. I mean, and again, we can intersperse some of these anecdotes throughout the podcast, yeah, but
I feel if we have this like 20 straight minutes of your terrible, terrible dates with film bros, I'm going to want to die. Out of shame for my gender and humanity.
I was going to say we could intersperse them if so that we don't just like seem like we're just going to crush like the souls of Tarantino fans during this first hour.
And this is coming from three people who generally enjoy the film, right? So like I don't want to give the impression that this is going to be just us bashing Tarantino right. and the film. Like, I think it works. I think it's entertaining.
Oh, yeah.
I think it's, yeah, successful. Mm-hmm. But I think we as grad students and perhaps more importantly as instructors, teachers, TAs, often encounter people who openly embrace Tarantino, right. including these early films and his later films, in lieu of perhaps other films and filmmakers that were influenced by Tarantino. So I'm just wondering, like, how do you feel about, like, using Tarantino as sort of a teaching tool? Is that effective? And how do you feel generally about how students feel about him?
I mean, I will say that I think part of what makes him appealing to young people, generally young males in film school especially, and I will say I was a young male in film school in the year 2000, so that's right when this movie is still like in its big afterglow, like everyone loves it, and Jackie Brown had come out not that long before that as well, so like I was part of that sort of hotbed of like 18-year-old men adoring Tarantino. I was always a little bit more of a Wes Anderson type myself, but like I was
knew
there.
It.
I was part of that.
Called
I mean,
it.
I don't think I hide this even a tiny bit.
That's why I like you.
Thank you. I think that what makes this film so accessible and what makes it really effective as a teaching tool is it's not hiding what it's doing. Like, it is very style forward. You can point to anything and be like, do you see what's going on? And it's so obvious in the editing, in the very stylized dialogue. Like, it's so aware of its own tricks and so proud of them that it's really putting everything out front. So insofar as the value, like the thing we need to do when we're teaching how to watch a movie, how to break down a movie, is saying, do you see what's going on? If you're watching something really subtle and sophisticated, maybe they don't. Maybe a 2-minute clip isn't enough to sort of extract all that from. With a movie like this, it's just bashing you over the head with it, which can be, for an entire feature film as an adult, wearying. And I won't lie, like this is a 2.5-hour movie plus, mm-hmm. and it's a long 2.5 hours. Like, it did not fly by. But when you're 18 and you're just sort of sucking down this like energy, I think that makes it a little bit more graspable. And I think that is why I would still use this to teach, I mean, a lot of things. Editing, certainly, certain aspects of screenwriting, like the story structure is another thing that's really front and center. Like, you can't not notice the story structure in this. So it's obvious.
Yeah.
And I don't say that as a criticism, just as sort of an identification. Like, it's really, really obvious.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think there were multiple ways you could use this film to teach. I mean, I think even though for me personally, like some of what I actually don't like about the film, I think ironically makes it a useful teaching tool because for me, I often tend to prefer more in-depth psychological analyses of characters or more of this integrated feeling. But for the film, it is such a hodgepodge of kind of these individual exchanges and moments that really are just meant to be appealing in and of themselves, like the Royale, you know, burger exchange, that you could easily just take one of these clips and you don't need to set up the background context for the students. They can just see what's going on with the dialogue or see what's going on with the scene hook where, you know, we'll cut away from them or fade out from them dancing to suddenly they're carrying home the trophy. Okay, our answer to that narrative question. So I do think, you know, what Tim was sort of pointing to as well, the fact that maybe this film didn't innovate any particular strategy, but it combines so many different strategies in one place that it does, you know, make it fairly useful for teaching any of those techniques, especially if you're trying to explain postmodernism to the students or trying to explain, you know, ways that it's trying to differ from traditional genre gangster films and incorporate some of these indie cinema characteristics with the pacing and the unusual leaving of dangling narrative clauses. I think that, yeah, it could absolutely be helpful. For me, dark comedy was the big takeaway. I was like, oh, my students have been mentioning this for years, and I really should be using it more because it actually is a perfect example of what we talk about for dark comedy in that class.
Yeah. I mean, it's occurring to me now as we're talking about this that I'm basing a lot of my assumptions about what about the enduring affection for this movie on my experience in film school, which was at this point a long time ago. And so I'm like, do you get the sense that the kids still like this movie?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah?
Do you want to... I don't want to interrupt.
Oh, well, I mean, I just... part of the reason that I find the film interesting but was hesitant to see it for so long was because I was able to, over the course of teaching, identify about, you know, three or four different male directors and in particular films where if I asked a male film student, or honestly any male under the age of 50, they would say, this is my favorite director, this is my favorite film. And Pulp Fiction and Tarantino are always consistently there. And they're still saying it when I go around and ask them for favorite films. Why would be the interesting question? And I would be happy to get into that as well.
By all means.
Well, this actually, I obviously think you do tend to find a interest in the kind of violence or the idea of nihilism that a lot of these films contain. But I actually think that when I was watching this film, it really struck me that this film, Fight Club, but also other films that they tend to be drawn to and that are often crafted for younger male audiences, often do have a very libertarian ideology. And actually, this generation of students, iGen, they've said has actually become that scientists or sociologists that have been conducting studies of them have found that they tend to be even more libertarian in their political ideologies than the millennials or than Generation X, though they see them as having more in common than with Generation X, which I think is interesting given that for Generation X, this would be one of those critical films. So it may be why it still has that legacy, that if they are in this libertarian mood where they don't trust government and they don't trust on both the right and the left, and then you're getting a film where we get it glorified, these gangsters are glorified, and particularly the idea that one just has to follow one's sort of moral code, and even though one's a gangster, they can have this redemptive moment. And at the restaurant at the end, all we need is one guy who's brave enough to stand up to the robbers and who will happen to have a gun on him, and he can have his moment of alone masculine competence. But that's in Die Hard, that's in other films as well. So I think that it really fits well within that that trajectory in how a lot of young men are raised on certain types of films. And then I think it does carry over into the ideology of this generation. You know, not it's a big assumption, but it is a trend that it seems like studies are noticing.
Young man, care to respond?
I mean, I agree with everything you've said, except that I don't know how much it explains Pulp Fiction specifically, because I think that so much of American pop culture, not even movies, like going into the 1800s, glorifies those same things in a lot of ways. I mean, look at Western dime novels and things of that nature.
Yeah.
So for me, the question is why Pulp Fiction out of all the manifestations of that? Because like if you go back in time to say 1997 or 1998, it looks like Boondock Saints is hitting even bigger than Pulp Fiction did and is doing all the same stuff, but sort of in a cruder, more like sort of less artful way.
Yeah.
So why does Boondock Saints sort of lose all of its reputation by like 2004, 2005 and Pulp Fiction is still with us? And I don't have an answer for that. Like, the only answer I have is, well, because it's better made.
Well, right. Yeah, I would agree with that. I mean, the thing is, you are going to see those cultural trends, but the particular canonical text that those young men will cling on to are the ones that are well made or enjoyable or that are superior.
I just don't have enough faith to assume that quality in and of itself, like, gives something longevity.
Yeah, no, it's true. I mean, it's interesting. And to think about the context of its release, I mean, it may be that just as we've said, it's trying so many different strategies at once that, you know, would that give it this kind of fresh, the seeming freshness or the seeming defiance of conventional, you know, narrative structures, that if you combine that with the libertarian message, it may be a particularly potent combination.
I mean, it is a good marriage of form and content, I would say, in that it does have a sort of like radicalism about it. And I think that that sort of bleeds into the, there are no rules about how we're going to tell the story. There are no rules about how we're going to live our lives. Like, I think that's all kind of, it feels like it's going all in the same direction. Sort of in the same way that like Godard, who is such an obvious influence on this film. And I think Tarantino has even acknowledged that, certainly with his previous film, I think he acknowledged it, Reservoir Dogs.
Well, the dancing scene is inspired by Band of Outsiders, the dancing scene.
That tracks for sure. But like, and that's the thing, like that's another, like Godard's films are all about gangsters and people like waving guns around. So I don't know if maybe there's just some sense that, I mean, in Tarantino's case, I wonder if it's that he believes in gangsters or that he believes in Godard. And I think that's one of the things that really stands out and stood out in the 90s even. It is not a film about Los Angeles. It is not a film about gangsters. It is a film about watching movies.
I
wonder if that's also part of why it's sustained so well, is because it really speaks to people who sort of don't have a framework for the world, but do have a framework for engaging with pop culture.
Though it's interesting because that you bring, well, 2 points. Like, what? Well, I'll go with the easier point first, but what you mentioned about all these references, what I find interesting about a lot of the Tarantino fans, especially the male bros, as well, bless their hearts, they're not all bros, but some of the ones I go on dates on, what's interesting is, you could argue the sustainability is because it's about the love of sort of film watching and viewing, but they don't know any of the references. They haven't seen the Godard film. They don't know, like, I always have to point out to them, like they would never know Mamie Van Doren. Like, they might know Marilyn Monroe, but often that would come up on dates where they're like, I just love that, you know, he's so intertextual and that he just, like, you know, really captures the love of movies. And I'm like, oh, like, which reference did you really like? They're like, well, like, I mean, I haven't seen any of them, but I mean, he just loves filmmaking. I'm like, okay.
I love that you've uncovered a population of men who know the word intertextual and don't know who Jean-Luc Godard is.
Oh, this is very typical.
I believe it. It's both exciting and horribly depressing to me that these people exist in the world.
That's the problem, is that they've learned sort of some of the word choices to try to wield their, like, claims of intellectual superiority, but then if you probe beneath the surface, there's not as much going on. But yeah, that so that was one thing that, right, is that really why, if they can't get the references, or is it just the violence or the beauty of the cinematography at that point? And the second thought I had was, you were bringing up, Tim, how it's this, like, it in some ways it seems like the form matches the content. And with Godard as an influence, but something that kept coming up in the reviews and a thought I had as I was watching the film myself was, with Godard, he is a political filmmaker, or becomes a very political filmmaker. So for him, form is absolutely, like, inseparable from content. But with Tarantino, the criticism is that there is no substance, or that there isn't really a clear political message, or even just a takeaway message about the characters or the plot line. You know, because like if you guys had to say what should we take away from this film? Because that was something that I wondered as I watched it. How could I boil down with how the three narratives connected and what our overall takeaway was supposed to be?
I mean, I would not wish to be this cynical, but I think you kind of nailed it before when you said that the basic vibe is, you know, go do your thing, Superman, and be the guy who saves the day with your gun.
Mm-hmm.
I think that is the message. And
yeah.
I think there's a certain bad habit critics get into when they say, oh, this movie doesn't have a message. They mean it doesn't have a message that I approve of, but I still enjoyed watching this. I think Pulp Fiction's message is, especially if you look at the Bruce Willis and then the third segment, it really is about just like, you're good so you can do violence. Like,
Or could we say that like violence can be
violence
redemptive?
It's redemptive.
Right.
Yes.
Because we see sort of the three narratives have the common connection, I guess. Because at first I was like, why the hell is the gold watch here? Like, what is the... But I
still
guess...
ask that question.
Yeah. But I guess technically it's like Vince and Vega, we see them doing bad things, but then Vega shows he saves Mia's life. He is capable of this redemptive action. Gold watch, he cheated Marsalis. He is shown to behave badly, but then he has a redemptive moment of saving Marsalis from them and then Samuel L. Jackson in the final... Right. I never say Jules, right? That's his name. I always just say Samuel L. Jackson.
I mean,
he's so distinctive. But Jules in that third part, right? Again, this redemption at the end. So I guess all three have that in common. But right, like, is that a? I guess it's, how substantial is that, or interesting is the message?
I'm not
like,
arguing it's either substantial or
right,
interesting.
Right.
Just that it exists.
Yeah, because it's kind of like, oh, great, we now know that we can redeem ourselves by like shooting a group of gay men who try to have sex with us. Woo! Like,
yeah.
But I guess you're right. Like that, it can have a message.
It has a message. It's
true.
Just not a message I would care to dwell on.
Yeah. I mean, I guess my takeaway is not that. Violence is as a tool of redemption is like very clearly something that one could take away. But
yeah.
It's ultimately just like. Violence is cool. More importantly,
and
everything about this movie is very much about presenting certain like cinematic tropes as cool, like reinventing them, just turning all these various cliches into an amalgamation of something resembling a story, or like Megan, you mentioned like vacuous postmodernism. Like, I can't think of a better way to describe the film. But I guess my question is ultimately, does this sort of pastiche result in a coherent one narrative? I guess it does, right? And then a coherent film. Like, how does this translate?
To me, it didn't. I didn't think that meant it wasn't. Like, I do think it works overall as a film, and I absolutely can see why people enjoy it. I just actually think it could have been done better. I don't think the middle section ever fully gels for me.
Mm-hmm.
As long as I can remember, I've never liked the gold watch. This viewing just really sealed for me how little is going on in that sequence that I enjoy watching on any level.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of what's good.
I think the Christopher Walken bit is good.
Oh, sure.
That
is,
that's it.
But after that, it's
then we just have like Gay Panic the movie.
But
you know,
even before it gets to Gay Panic the movie, because that's only like the last.
That's true.
Half
and then the girlfriend, like there's
the
so
girlfriend
few
is,
the girlfriend
interesting
is
female
such
characters.
A '90s girlfriend trope that it's almost painful.
Yeah.
Like I mean, I could go on about the representation of women as well in this film, but at least Mia Wallace's character is given a bit more interest or a bit more of subverting an initial femme fatale expectation. There's at least a bit more substance there. With that girlfriend in Gold Watch, why is she there?
She's there to screw up. She's there to be an airhead.
Right, pretty much.
Right. And then, I mean, even in the Roseanne Arquette character, I mean, consistently, every female who is, who I guess we could make an exemption for Mia Wallace, but she also ends up just a damsel in distress.
Mm-hmm. Right. And so, the curious cat.
Yeah.
Or what do you call it? Pandora's box.
Sure. Yeah.
She can't resist more.
Exactly.
Cocaine.
Yeah. Yeah. So I guess, and I guess, again, I agree with you that that segment could very easily be axed and we wouldn't miss
no.
it.
And I think to Megan, your point that you could easily see all of this being done better. One of the things that I think is kind of weird and interesting about the film, I think all of it was done better by him in later films, but he never tried to do everything this is doing. Like, if we look at the fractured narrative reassembling itself in a more like appealing way, like I think that's what Kill Bill is. Like it's better at that.
Okay.
And Jackie Brown is better at like violence and gangster culture in Los Angeles. And there are things Inglourious Basterds is better at. I think what's still interesting about Pulp Fiction is that it's where he's trying to do every single thing he can get his head around. And his later filmography is about doing some of those things.
Well, and it's interesting because I reading about the production of the film did make the disjointedness made sense because they wanted it to be a short originally. Mm-hmm. And then it's like, oh, well, we don't have a market for this. Right. Let's just keep adding on. So if you do initially see this as a Vincent Vega, Mia Wallace skit, and then you have to keep adding, maybe Gold Watch really was just inserted in there because we need to lengthen it. And a lot of apparently some of the scenes were meant to go in True Romance. So it's like, oh, we're transplanting these. There's that kind of fluidity.
And I think it's worth keeping in mind. I mean, this is an obvious point, but the film is called Pulp Fiction.
Yeah.
What I think it's meant to evoke, there are a couple things I think it's trying to evoke, but one of them is like you pick up a ratty magazine in the 1970s full of lurid stories about vicious crime, and you're just leafing through it. It has three stories in it, and two of them happen to have most of the same characters as protagonists.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, so I feel like we've been a little bit negative. So maybe let's talk about things that we do. Like, I encouraged it, and I will encourage it later on. But I do think, like, there are elements of this that are pretty amazing.
Yeah.
Right? And so let's talk about what's your favorite segment?
Ooh.
I would say the first, so there's the prologue and then there's three chapters, right? So that's how we're talking about
sure.
it. I would say that the first chapter, Vincent Vega and Marcellus Wallace's Wife, I think is the official title of it, is probably the one that works the best.
Me too.
I do think the Bonnie situation is the one I enjoy thinking about the most because it's so weird.
Yeah, no, I would absolutely agree. Like for me, that segment between Vincent and Mia, I was the most invested, interested, intrigued by their unfolding dynamic, and then the other two, I just each moment didn't sort of build in the same sure. in the same way for me. So I absolutely enjoyed that first portion the best.
Yeah, and just to be clear, the Bonnie segment is the cleaning of the brain out of the backseat.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So here's what I love about this. So I think it's on the one hand, it's a movie about reading grimy magazines. I think on the other thing, it's a movie about sitting down at about 11 in the morning and watching cable TV in the 1970s until you stop. Because it's basically three episodes. And the way I've always thought about it is it's a late episode and then the series finale of the Jules and Vincent show, followed by its spinoff, the failed pilot for the Butch show, which has everything, including like we see Butch in a late episode of Jules and Vincent. We see Vincent in the pilot episode.
Oh, man. And it is a backdoor pilot. Oh, my God.
And the Bonnie situation is the episode from every awful, hacky sitcom about, you guys, my wife is coming home. We need to throw away all these beer cans, except it's about a headless, bloody corpse.
Oh, yeah.
And that's what I think is kind of cool and weird about it.
Okay.
Well, that contrast you mentioned, I mean, I think for me, like getting off my negative Nancy train to what I did enjoy. I did think, like, especially working on comedy, I do think that the use of irony for comedy is very well done in this film. And even with how consistent it was, every single scene he manages to have that comedic twist, like for moments of genuinely terrifying violence. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, again, when Jules is just eating the burger is a prelude to murdering
which
people.
Is the commercial in the middle of the TV episode.
Oh, I didn't see that.
This is what I'm saying. Like, I have a really bizarrely elaborate, like, watching Pulp Fiction is actually watching TV theory.
Oh, my God. I mean, I could see it. But that and the pacing and buildup where, like, we've talked about this in comedy class where for... Like, most people think of dark comedy as, oh, there's death in it, or there's an uncomfortable subject matter. It's like, no, for it to really, like, that's most comedy. Like, most comedy deals with taboo subjects. We get into dark comedy when there is genuinely an element of disturbance that does not go away or can't be compartmentalized. Like, you are equally disturbed as well as laughing or laughing out of discomfort. So it's not just that, oh, there's something amusing and like in like an Arsenic and Old Lace where these women are killing people. That's in the realm of like complete, you know, absurdity. So we don't feel that. But here there's so much about the pacing, the where that real sense of realism is added so that you can't really fully remove yourself into like a play frame for comedy. You do have the actual, you know, violence and the way that it's depicted, but you still get those incongruities and those moments of a complete surprise, like the fact that all the bullets do miss them, or the fact that like that they're talking about something like God and how they've been saved, and then he just accidentally shoots him in the back of the car is the sudden disruption to that kind of confidence. And so I thought that was really well done. And even though I get annoyed when filmmakers make intertextual references, sometimes when it's so well done, it can really cause pleasure. And like I did really enjoy the Psycho homage where he sees Marcellus in the street.
That's
like
right
really
great.
Especially when it's in such a carefully similar context. It's not just out of the blue. It's like he is also on the run from a crime, like in fear of discovery. It's enough of a close link in terms of content that I think there's a payoff there.
Sure.
So yeah. So I think those two aspects, like especially the dark comedy and the skill of some of those homages, I really enjoyed.
Yeah. And I mean, that Psycho reference you mentioned, that is just one of many different influences that are jumbled up in this movie. And I guess to take it back to kind of potentially negative space, like, how do we feel about this era, this postmodern era, where filmmakers are attempting to incorporate a lot of different influences and using them as references? And I guess it sort of begs the question, where does like quotation and an appropriation begin? Because I think that one might argue that Tarantino, by referencing a lot of like blaxploitation movies and basically co-opting them, is sort of removing them from their historical context. And ultimately, like, who is actually going back and rewatching these films? Is there an element of, I mean, I guess I get the question is like, how troublesome do you find it? Is it problematic?
Are we referring to Quentin having his undying love affair with the N-word?
Yes. Perhaps. Yeah. That's what I mean. I feel like we would be remiss if we didn't talk about it a little bit, because I do think, I wonder what the reaction was at the time, and then does that still fly? Are we okay with this?
I mean, we could never make that film now.
Yeah.
We are not okay with it now. At the time, because I was around when this opened, I don't remember it being a thing. And there was definitely like a wave of movies where white filmmakers and white actors were using that word, other words that we would consider deeply uncomfortable. And there were critics talking about this as though it was annoying, but not anyone talking about it as though it was some sort of like moral failure.
Yeah, because it looks like some critics like said they were bothered by it, but it almost seemed more like, oh, it's like too repetitive, or they're just trying to be cool.
The example that I think of is actually from a very different movie, Bullworth, the Warren Beatty film about a senator or a congressperson or something who has brain cancer.
Yeah.
And to resist, like, he decides to become a rapper, and he's played by Warren Beatty, so he's this old white dude. And the criticism that got leveled against that film's use of language was not that it was bad, but that it was ludicrous.
Okay.
Basically.
I see. Yeah. I mean, I guess like it's but one thing.
The critics I read, I shouldn't.
Sure.
Speak for every
sure.
Critic,
yeah. I guess the problem that I have with it is there are multiple issues, but I guess the problem here for me is that he's using that word as like he's as if to sort of ingratiate himself with the black community. Like, right. Quentin Tarantino, you are a white man. Like, who are you trying to fool? Why do you think you can get away with this? And yet, I guess he did. I don't know.
Well, and it looks like someone at the time, I think it was Todd Boyd, oh, my relative, argued that he felt that Tarantino was using it in the film to signify the ultimate level of hipness for white males that have, like, very historically used sort of elements of cool black masculinity and appropriated it for themselves. So, I mean, it's tricky because Samuel L. Jackson has defended the controversy came up, I think, during Django Unchained, right, where he said it in the interview and was getting angry that they were telling him not to say it. Mm. So it does seem like for him as a black man, he feels that there is an element of reclaiming the word and, like, reclaiming it in order to, like, deprive it of its power. And he's saying, well, we say this to each other for that purpose in the black community, so why can't, you know, Tarantino? Like, I was the one saying it. Like, I was doing this of my own accord. So I'm a bit on the fence about it. I do think it's – I do get annoyed with kind of how much it's in the film, and I do think he probably is using it for a bit of hipness. But given that Jackson was such a kind of co-sponsor and involved in that creative decision, I'm not as kind of purely putting the blame on Tarantino's doorstep there.
I think I wouldn't have as much of a problem were it not for the Bonnie – segment where Tarantino himself says it.
Oh God, I think know. He just also, can I just say, he needed to not be in that film.
Like, he needs to not ever act in any
he's
context.
Not good.
He's very bad at
he's
it.
He's not good. Like, he's trying so hard. Like, okay, I need to imitate Samuel L. Jackson's shouting here. Like, you guys get the fuck out of my place. And he's just that whiny voice. I could not.
Yeah, no, him deciding to stop casting himself was a good call.
Was very bad.
Has he learned that lesson? He was in Django.
He's not in Hateful Eight, though.
Okay.
No,
that's
he is.
True.
I take it back. He is. Okay. He hasn't given himself a role of such weight.
Okay.
Ever since.
Now it's just the Hitchcock, you know.
Yeah.
Sure. We get a little cameo. Yeah.
Well, he's a voice on an answering machine in Jackie Brown. So all you get is that shrill nasal squeaking. So it's great.
Well, I think this transitions nicely into what we think of the actual actors in the movie. So this is sort of like John Travolta's big comeback role, right? And I promised that we would talk about the hair, and I feel like it's important that we do. I wouldn't want to let our listeners
this
down.
This movie's hair game is non-incidental.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Let's be very clear. It has a lot of hair going
on. So what do we think his hair influences for that film? Because I personally loved the hair. I'm not a Travolta, you know, fan in general, but that hair was working for me.
That did something to you, huh?
Well, I was happy they weren't trying to make him into a sex symbol because he usually doesn't. He just doesn't do it for me in the sex symbol department. It's like, oh, like he's aging. They're just fully embracing it. This is almost hotter as a result of it. It's like when I see man bod or dad bod and I get excited. But I'm wondering, was there a particular film reference for that?
If there is, I don't know what it is.
Because it's not of the time period.
No, it's very weird.
Yeah.
It almost looks like some kind of vampire, vampiric.
But it's like vampires are meant to look like Byronic and sexy.
Right.
And that just looks like he doesn't even know what shampoo is.
As you said, grease personified.
Yeah.
And like, I can definitely, like the other two main hairdos, Samuel Jackson's and Uma Thurman's, like it's very easy to say, okay, here's what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
With Travolta's, I have no idea.
I don't know.
It's like, I don't know if it feels French. Like, it feels sort of like there's some sort of, like, is there a Jean-Pierre Melville film he's referencing or something? But, like, I can't think of which one it would be.
Man, is there, like, a Godfather extra that we missed? Maybe we got to go back.
Well, the only thing I could think of was if there were, because my first thought was the vampire reference, but I'm wondering if there are these sort of, like, 60s, 70s cheap horror films or even like Hammer films where like some people are wearing that hair in the 70s.
Because like in all those gothic horrors, they're like wearing very close cut hair because they're meant to look old fashioned.
Right, I would think so.
Well, he's kind of dressed like a cowboy, right? He's got a bolo tie. Doesn't he wear boots, cowboy boots?
Does he wear
like,
cowboy boots?
I think, not sure. Now I have to go back and watch.
But then how many cowboys had that hair?
It's a good question.
How many human men throughout the tens of thousands of years of civilization have had that hair?
Oh, probably more since that film has come
out. But... I'm sure you're correct.
Oh, God.
That's like it feels like 90s hair, but I wonder if it feels like 90s hair because that movie influenced 90s pop culture.
Because I don't think that really was not... Like, 90s, they were pretty close-cropped. I mean, the 80s, you get longer male hair. So I'm wondering if that's, like, some kind of... Maybe. Carry over.
Sure, yeah.
I don't know, but it's incredible.
Yeah. Well, I was reading somewhere that the Jerry curl that Samuel L. Jackson is wearing is influenced by N.W.A.
Well,
so
my understanding was that was a PA fucked up.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
It was supposed to be an afro, and the PA was like black hair.
Describe
a Jerry curl wig.
Oh God.
And that works. I mean, it's not a flattering look, but it works.
It's memorable.
Yeah.
It. Yes.
Yeah. And then Mia Wallace.
Anna Karina.
Yeah.
Straight down the line.
Yeah, you think?
Oh, interesting. Because I almost, when I first saw her, I almost thought Louise Brooks, like
Pandora's
Box.
That's what I thought. Yeah.
And that kind of, especially because of the black.
Yeah.
The black and that crop.
And I think that's correct, but I also feel like assuming that he's a voracious cinephile, but I also feel like expecting him to know silent German versus knowing Anna Karina films. We know he watched The French New Wave.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I would only think, I wouldn't be surprised if he, for some reason, did use Louise Brooks as a reference. It would only be because the images of her are so pop culturally proliferated, as opposed to I have sat through Pandora's Box, though he should. Yeah.
I mean, again, I feel like he probably has, because I feel he has seen everything. He's just very choosy in a bad way about what he references.
Right.
True, very true.
Yeah, has there been a Douglas Sirk reference in his films?
There's a Douglas Sirk reference in Pulp Fiction.
Oh, wait, which one was that?
John Travolta orders a Douglas Sirk steak.
Oh, you're right. Never mind. There is. I mean, from his actual film.
No, that I don't believe there has.
I don't know if I want to watch that movie.
His version.
Maybe, I don't know. Yeah.
His version of female melodrama. Oh, my God.
I mean, it would be better than another goddamned Western.
Well, that's the thing. I would be curious to see, can he do it? Can he actually attempt to do some sort of intimate, like, traditionally feminized, like,
that would,
because
like, I feel like if he said, Quentin, can you do a woman's picture? He'd say, I did it, Kill Bill Volume 2. Traditionally feminized, I think it would be too ugly to even cope with what it would look
like. Yeah, but I would be fascinated to see, because most of them try once. Like, even Scorsese has Alice Doesn't Look Here anymore.
I think it's one of Scorsese's best films.
I still haven't seen it. Ugh, it kills me. But yeah, this would be interesting.
And I mean,
it's
on Netflix. And actually, like, Spielberg had Always. So yeah, so all of these, like, boy directors did try.
Yeah.
But so
Tarantino, it's your turn.
I don't know. I think it would be gross in, like, the most unproductive way.
Yeah. Okay. Well, so just beyond the hair.
Yeah.
Beyond the
hair. What do we think of the performances, right? This, again, resurrected John Travolta's career. And yet, like, he's doing something very strange. This is a very mannered performance.
Yes.
How did he get away with this? How was he nominated for an Academy Award?
I
thought he was great.
I mean, this is the thing. Why does it work?
Well, but you know what? I'll just say this quickly because I want to hear what Tim has to say. But I just thought, when you say how could he get away with it, I think this is what his performances were always like. His performance in Grease or Saturday Night Fever, those are strange performances.
They are.
Like, those are not naturalist. Like, every gesture, it's very much like, okay, Sandy. Like, he has his mannerisms. And so it is this kind of compelling combination of, like, him behaving the way he thinks a classical Hollywood actor would behave, but then also these little touches of, like, a boyish, like, giggle or naturalism. Like, it's an interesting dichotomy. But I think it just seemed like an extension of those other performances with different mise-en-scène and hair to kind of give it a bit of freshness.
Yeah, and I mean, basically what I was going to say is not at all dissimilar from what you just said. Like, I think the thing about the film as a whole, you know, it comes out of this moment in American indie cinema where American indie cinema is synonymous with, it's artistically good because it's more real, it's more down to earth, it's like, it's too cheap to have, like, all of the sort of gaudy spectacle. And along comes Tarantino with this film that sort of borrows bits and pieces from indie realism in that it's set in Los Angeles playing itself, like a sort of very down rent. Megan, when we were watching this, you mentioned how cheap the cinematography looks, and that really leapt it out at me this time. It's like, it is so much lower budget than his later stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, even though it's drawing from this kind of aesthetic tradition of indie naturalism, it's so arch. The dialogue is like from the moon.
Mm-hmm.
Like the characters are all this like sort of weird amalgamation of pop culture references. So it's bringing in naturalism, but it's not doing naturalism. That's sort of one of the things it's doing. And I think what the actors are really good at are playing that in a way that doesn't feel like they're struggling with it, which the history of cinema is littered with actors who don't know how to cope with really mannered dialogue. And I think one of the things that's great about Pulp Fiction is that all of the major cast members, except Bruce Willis, and God knows except for the actress who plays his girlfriend.
Oh, goodness.
Again, because that's a shitty sequence. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
But the other actors are all really good at sort of coping with these weird, curly-cued sentences that Tarantino is giving them. And I think the performances are terrific in this film.
Oh, yeah.
Because they are so strange and inexplicable in some ways.
Indeed. Well, so you mentioned like that there was kind of a blossoming indie cinema scene in the 1990s. I think let's talk a little bit more about where Quentin Tarantino fits in within this community, I guess, if you want to call it that. I think it was sort of like it wasn't so much a community as it was like individual scenes where a few directors managed to rise above the rest because they were more accessible than others. So when we think 1990s indie cinema, what do we think of? Is it this, I guess we could say like there is like a branch that is this kind of postmodern pastiche kind of sort of regurgitating other styles of the past, or regurgitating is a very negative word, but you know, like
a lot of them are very
revisiting.
Negative films.
Yeah,
that deserve to be
that's
condemned.
True. Yeah, yeah. And then there's something. Then there's like I would say, I don't know. I don't think of Richard Linklater as someone who is necessarily quoting anyone, but some might disagree.
I mean, he basically made a trilogy of Roma homages.
That's true. I guess that's true. Yeah, very true.
but it comes back to the French New Wave.
Sure, exactly. Exactly, right? So I guess that is the question.
Anderson called a Truffaut pastiche.
That is true. So. There you go. There you go. So who am I talking about, Tim? And like, and do you think that it is fair to lump all these filmmakers together from like an industrial perspective, from a stylistic perspective? Is it just like convenient shorthand, 1990s indie cinema?
I think it's convenient shorthand, although I think it's motivated by, in large part, the impact of Tarantino's first two films, Reservoir Dogs and Pulp Fiction, demonstrated a marketplace for these cheaply made, very idiosyncratic personal visions. Post Pulp Fiction, which was the big like coming out party for Miramax, every major distributor picks up an indie arm. They're all producing these films that are in this sort of weird liminal place between like, yeah, it's indie because it's cheap and it's made without compromise, but also we're giving it like a huge Oscar push and a wide release.
Oh, yeah.
So are these films indie anymore? Not meaningfully, but they sort of adopt indie as like a branding strategy. And I think that's Pulp Fiction's legacy. Meanwhile, like you look at the really indie films, I'm thinking of like Jim Jarmusch, the careers of several wonderful filmmakers that didn't really pick up, like Julie Dash, who made one great film in 91 and then sort of couldn't like get money after that. These people they remain marginalized. Like no one's talking about the Jim Jarmusch moment in pop culture, even though he's been steadily working for the last 30 years, because they are still making films that are thorny and weird and outside of the mainstream. And in a lot of cases, Julie Dash being one of them, like not pandering to white boys, which, you know, God bless Anderson and Tarantino and all those, but they're white boy filmmakers.
Yeah.
Well, and it is a sort of good question. What you're bringing up is how they're sort of defining a formula for indie that can go mainstream in this period. And like, I mean, Miramax, I was going back through like the best picture Oscars for that decade. And it's just, I mean, Miramax just just becomes the norm or is so in control, like Shakespeare in Love in 98. Is American Beauty Miramax
American
or is that
Beauty's,
Fox Searchlight?
That's SKG, DreamWorks.
That's DreamWorks. Okay. But like even that and a lot of the reviews, they were bringing up comparisons with their model.
They were trying to become like a new version of Miramax that didn't have Disney under like as its backer, basically.
Yeah, but it's just incredible how just every, you know, most of the major nominees after that point, mm-hmm. like with an exception like Braveheart, maybe, you're really getting this idea of, you know, these are going to be the new Oscar nominees, yep. like these, you know, studio offshoots that, you know, produce only certain types of indie cinema.
Right. And that's the thing, like, is it in any way coherent, A, to call Shakespeare in Love an indie film? And B, is it in any way coherent to say that Shakespeare in Love and Pulp Fiction belong to the same movement?
Mm. Right.
And I just, if there is a coherent way to make that argument, I don't know what it is.
Well, speaking of the Academy Awards, this film, Pulp Fiction, has become sort of a contentious issue amongst Oscar trackers and people who care about such things. I would say probably the three of us would include ourselves among that. Tim, I know you would, right?
I am an Oscar person in a somewhat unbecoming way.
Nonsense. You're amongst friends.
I still follow them and shamefully care.
Right.
I keep extensive spreadsheets of all the categories so I know which films I still haven't seen that were nominated in, say, black and white art direction, of which there are many.
That's beautiful. Well, Pulp Fiction... very famously, only won one Academy Award and lost the big one, Best Picture, to Forrest Gump.
Okay,
and people have feelings about this.
People have real strong feelings about this. They also have real strong feelings about Shawshank having more or less the same track record, except I think Shawshank won nothing. I'm not pro Shawshank.
I'm fine with that.
The same people who like pitch a shit over Pulp Fiction not winning pitch the same shit over
That's
Shawshank.
Because, again, I'm sorry, that is the same male youth contingent. They all say Shawshank or Pulp Fiction as some of their favorite films. And there's also the same kind of libertarian ideology. Okay, I'm going to stop
obsessing. You're totally right. You're right on the money, yes.
And, like, no woman, but that's okay.
Yeah.
Yes.
But, yeah. But... Megan, do you care that Pulp Fiction was robbed? Robbed, I tell you?
So I will say this. Despite me seeing it and going, like these film bros, what are they talking about? I will say that is, it should have won over Forrest Gump. Almost any film of 94 should have won over Forrest Gump because that is an atrocious film. And especially for the stylistic, you know, skill in Pulp Fiction and its contributions to pop culture.
But in Forrest Gump, he talks to John Kennedy.
You see.
But it's CGI.
I know.
And it's
they take Gary Sinise's legs away using computers.
What studio did Forrest Gump?
Paramount.
So it was a major. That was the major thing.
That year... Yeah. We have a Paramount film against a Miramax. I think Shawshank was Warner, but it was like a low-budget Warner.
Mm.
Quiz Show, which was an indie, and then Four Weddings and a Funeral, which is not just an indie.
Yeah.
It's a British indie. So like Forrest Gump was clearly the vote of confidence in the studio system.
Mm.
Also, it's easy to say from years later, this got robbed, that got robbed, how dare that film won. Forrest Gump made an amount of money that would be ludicrous if it made it in 2019 for a character drama.
Right.
And it made it 25 years ago. Like, that movie was a juggernaut. It was not going to lose the Oscars at all.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, I completely could see. I mean, again, there's certain films like Titanic where they just would not have lost, but in my personal
The difference being
opinion.
That Titanic deserved all of those Oscars.
Yes. I would argue.
All right, Megan, you're about to make enemies of two very good friends.
No. For the technical Oscar, the technical Oscars, 100% cinematography, like the editing, absolutely. I just completely do not like the storyline and think the acting
is poor. It wasn't even nominated for Best Screenplay. So it didn't win.
But I don't know. I just have so many issues with that film. It's just not.
I think I will refer listeners to the Titanic Flixwise Favorites episode, in which it was very handily inducted into the Flixwise canon.
It is not worth turning this into a Titanic thing. I will say it is sloppy and it is saccharine, and I adore it.
Love it. Every single second.
Fun. Oh, it's fun. I just can't. There's parts I cannot.
Sure.
It's fair. But yes, but that, but right. But that would have been shocking if that had not won, given the, you know, the technological innovations and the huge success and resonance. And so I see your point, but I think we have a right to sort of personally.
I mean, clearly Pulp Fiction is better than Forrest Gump.
Yeah.
By a lot.
Yeah.
But like, I mean, the Oscars, like, I love following them. I think they're a fascinating time capsule. I think people who get, like, head up over the Oscars going to bad films are just like, well, they always go to bad films.
Green Book. Oh, God.
Like, how can you say Forrest Gump beating Pulp Fiction has tarnished the reputation of a statue that went to Green Book and The Greatest Show on Earth and
The last decade of Oscars in particular. I can't name what. Like, going from King's Speech onwards, it's just been a really rough decade.
It's been real dire.
Yeah. It's been really tough.
Yeah. All right. Well,
we should just abolish cinema, guys.
You're here. What are we even doing here, honestly?
I'm going to go become a farmer.
I feel like
that's a better use of
my time. Yeah. Well, okay, so as long as we're talking about film legacies, let's wrap things up by discussing the legacy of Pulp Fiction and whether we think it's worthy of the 127th spot on the critics poll. I guess let's start with how do you think it will endure?
I think it has. We are talking about it 25 years later.
Yeah.
Students still. And I will say, I think my experience with students is that they're more into his newer stuff, but they look back on this as the, like, once they get into the newer stuff, they go back and see the older stuff. So I don't know. But I mean, the fact that we're talking about it, it has endured.
Sure.
25 years is enough to say that it has endured, I think.
Yeah. Megan, do you have anything to add?
I mean, I would agree. I mean, I think it's had an enduring legacy for good and for bad.
Absolutely.
For stylistic innovation that goes mainstream as opposed to just, you know, hiding in these low budget efforts. I think obviously for the dialogue and for many of its strategies that has endured. I think there's also been some potentially detrimental legacies, especially with, as we've noted in this podcast, with the some young male cinephiles using that to denigrate the tastes of others or to, like, raise their own knowledge over others. I mean, again, I can't tell you how many dates where they'll just be like, oh, you study film. I love films. I love Tarantino. Like, because that one example, like, proves it. But, you know, then they'll say, oh, like, did you know that, like, he, like, was the first filmmaker to shoot on 64mm? I'm like, okay, well, no, that is a verbatim quote. And then they're like, oh, do you know what that is? Do you know what 64mm is? Oh, like, do you know about, like, you know, cinema, like, do you know about multi-story narratives? Like, they'll always bring it up, like to test my knowledge my graduate school program. And, like, so things like that. And I think the disturbing kind of content elements will come up because they'll say something like, I just love how he, like, tells it like it is. Like, he just really captures, like, the importance of violence.
He just took this someplace very dark. Yeah. So he's the Donald Trump of filmmaking.
That's kind of what they say. They're like, he captures, like, the nihilism of our society and, like, just the reality of violence that we will all encounter someday. And he just really, you know, captures, like, a very, you know, just a view of the world as it is. And they'll even say, like, it's a very masculine worldview. But they're using that as a good thing to justify it. And then if I try to, like, defer or be like, oh, well, there's other filmmakers I like as well, they're like, well, but, like, you must not, like, really like know that much about film then if like you're not like studying Tarantino. Like they always bring this up.
Oh my God.
I do think that's there. And actually the one final thing I would say is I do think that it may have a little unhealthily contributed to certain manic pixie dream girl visions through Mia Wallace's character, and they will often bring her up as, I mean, that just like when I saw that film, I just saw Mia Wallace and like I just knew that that was the woman for me, and like she just is so like different, and like that's just like I just want that level of excitement in my relationship. I'm like, yeah, because no normal human woman walks around saying two shakes of a lamb's tail. Like this does not happen.
I object to those men on numerous levels at this point.
But I think that says something if that's what they're all taking away from the film. Yeah. That may not be inherently Tarantino's fault, but it's interesting that for them that is the legacy, that is what they see as his contributions. Like it's either something aesthetic that they think he did first, but he did not actually do first, or it is about the violence or about like the idea of this kind of nihilistic do what the fuck I want worldview that they are attaching themselves to, even though there's so much more of the with the films that you could take away. So yeah, both good and bad, I would argue.
Yeah, and I mean that is, I feel like my whole body wants to just evacuate. From the minute you said 64mm onward, I was just like, oh my God.
Just don't go on Tinder with anyone who opens with their first line is, you study film? I love films. I love Tarantino.
God damn it.
Avoid those in the inbox.
And yeah, I want to not back off on what I said, but clarify what I said. That it has endured as a like thing people care about, I think is undeniable. Is it the 127th best film ever made? I would not say that's even a possibility. Influenced so, like, that's the thing. It's a film I appreciate historically because of what it allowed mainstream films to do stylistically. If I want to sit down and watch a Tarantino film that I think is a solid, well put together piece of cinema, this is not my first choice among Tarantino films.
Right.
Like, it might be my fourth, honestly.
Yeah. What would be your first Tarantino
Jackie
choice?
Brown, and then the two possible would be Kill Bill as a whole unit and Inglourious Bastards.
Yeah, I mean, that was my exact thought. Like, yes, Pulp Fiction endures because it had such has had such influence. We still see the ripples to this day. But on the whole, like, Jackie Brown works much better. Yeah. And like, it's an actually moving film, which I don't know that I can say for, frankly, for most of his oeuvre. Like, I don't think that's what they're about.
Yeah,
you know?
It's not something he values.
Yeah.
Oh, and actually, just to pop in the soundtrack, in terms of the music, a lot of the men that I talk to when they're talking about favorite films, they will either cite the like violence or like combination of humor and violence that they enjoy, or they'll cite music as a reason that they love a film. It's like often those elements versus when I talk, and again, this is making complete generalizations, but often when I talk to female students, it's more, I love this character, or I like this person, the you know, what it's about, or like, I like the story. But often with them, it's like, I like the spectacle of the violence, or I like the kind of aesthetic trappings of the music and the way that the content is cased and framed. And I mean, it would be interesting to know, would this film have really hit such a cultural nerve or become so popular without this amazing soundtrack that it has?
Yeah.
And that was certainly in the 90s, that was like one of the things you did. Like when you went to a Tarantino film, you were going because you wanted to see what cool music drop, like needle drops he was going to bring in. So I think that is certainly a huge part of its legacy, because now every fucking movie has like how many 70s hits? I mean, do we have Guardians of the Galaxy if we don't have Pulp Fiction?
Right.
Well, and we might wonder how that's affected indie
Lord.
Films.
Have you changed your mind? Is Pulp Fiction
Never
bad now?
Mind. I hate this movie.
Well, I'm just thinking about that you could see that maybe having a negative legacy on indie filmmakers or on young filmmakers, where often they will now think, oh, I just need to add a song, right. or I just need to add the right song to the background of the scene, and it will automatically be elevated and become worthwhile.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, this was a thing. Like, I think Tarantino is often credited with, like, using with the same kind of amalgam of musical influences, like using it to enhance whatever visual elements he's created. But I mean, also Scorsese is known for this as well. Yes. So, like, this was a thing that was happening in the 90s, right?
Anderson, Wes Anderson.
Anderson, sure, sure. So, yeah, like using music to sort of tell your story, to like using music as characterization.
Right.
It's it's pretty lazy, but it also works here because, like, it's so, like, that needle drop of Dick Dale is so great.
It's so good. It's the best thing that happens in the film is the opening credits, honestly. And I'm not even saying that to throw shade at the movie.
Yeah.
It's a really good opening credits.
It's great.
Well, and the kind of surprisingly fresh combination as well. It's not just, like, I think someone was mentioning this, like, with Forrest Gump, it's like, we have period music of this period when we're going into the 60s. But here, it's like, no, we're using surfer music or something that we wouldn't expect with the gangster genre, even though there you could argue again these kind of like libertarian bro culture overlaps.
Yeah.
So they actually do share interesting features, but we would never expect that normal combination.
Right. Sure, yeah. And like the whole idea of reclaiming takes on a different meaning here, but just the idea that like previously discarded texts or artists have been given new cachet, someone like Neil Diamond, who is like
Neil Diamond always had cachet, madam.
your aunt, your great aunt agrees with you.
Damn right.
What do we like? She's like for like a granny panty dropper or something like that. You know what I mean? Like, but here, you know, like girl, you'll be a woman soon. Like now, it's very cool.
Right,
you know.
Right.
And so,
or,
like,
or that teenage wedding song.
Oh, yeah, perfect. Chuck Berry.
Yeah.
I love that song. Anyway, but yeah, like, now within this context, now they have like new cultural cachet, right? And it works. And I think there is an art to sort of repurposing these songs. And as we've said, many have tried. But like they're like consistently throughout his career, like Quentin Tarantino has been very good at taking familiar either songs or scores and repurposing it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And we again we see this in very famously in Inglourious Basterds,
sure,
right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so like if nothing else, like I think we do have to like applaud him for that, because I do think that goes a long way in making this film.
Absolutely.
Pretty entertaining. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
All right. But so 127, should we vote on it? 127. What do you think, Megan?
I mean,
well, because off the top of my head, I'm just trying to think.
Just
like,
counting down 127 films.
What I put in front of that. And I have a feeling there would be at least 200 that would go in front of that film. But this is just like speculating off the top of my head. I mean, if I'm just basing it on personal favoritism and my own opinion, this would certainly not be there, because there's just it's not the kind of a film with the characters and the style that appeals to me. But even on a kind of just sheer film history level, oh man, with things like Passion of Joan of Arc, with like Dirk Dreyer,
I mean that's on
like,
there.
Which,
don't worry.
Yeah, I was going to say. But I feel like there's probably a lot of other films that should be there. My first instinct is no, but if I physically counted, maybe I would feel differently.
I, some years ago, published a top 115 of all time, and this film was not on there. I assume I could come up with 12 to add to my 115.
Yeah. I mean, I think when the next list is published, I think we will see Jackie Brown instead of Pulp Fiction.
I wouldn't be surprised. The emerging critics are definitely there. I'm not sure about the directors, but critics are definitely there.
Yeah.
In terms of elevating
critics
Jackie.
Like Jackie Brown better than Pulp Fiction.
Oh, yeah. Interesting. Okay.
Or Inglourious Basterds. I could see that.
Yeah, I think critics also like Inglourious Basterds.
Yeah.
Better.
Yeah. So, but I still think that, I mean, there are certainly other films from the 1990s that I think are superior.
It would make my top 127 of the 1990s.
There you go. Okay. Sam.
Oh, yeah.
Pretty handily.
Or if we made a list of like influence or like most influential films, that would absolutely
its
be
influence
on there.
Is definitely higher than its aesthetic qualities. And if we are weighting influence heavily, then maybe top 127.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that's fair. All right. Well, I think that's all. They'll never get tired of putting me down, and I never know when I come around what I'm gonna find. And that's the way we frame it, flicks-wise, that is. Listeners, what do you think of Pulp Fiction? Still Tarantino's greatest film? Come let us know on our Facebook page, facebook.com/flicks-wise. And if you want to come talk Jackie Brown with me, or really anything in the Pam Grier filmography, you can come follow me on Twitter. The handle is @flicks-wise. Unless you want to talk Kit Porter, in which case I'll just give you my home phone number. I'm sure nobody here gets that. That's okay. Coming up on FlixWise, truth be told, I don't really know. But we'll have more sight and sound entries in the near future. And there's also a Devil Wears Prada FlixWise favorites episode in the works. But stay tuned for updates. In the meantime, Tim, if people want to hear more of your voice, where should they look?
Well, they shouldn't look anywhere because my voice is non-corporeal.
Sure.
They should, however, visit alternateending.com. That's alternate ending, two E's in the middle, which is where I write movie reviews. And I also podcast with a couple very dear friends of mine.
Awesome.
We talk about movies every other week. So,
damn.
Yeah. If you're looking for a podcast that has a reliable schedule.
Oh, shade.
Just to like throw that out. I'm just not thinking of anything particular. I'm just saying it's every other Monday.
Fair enough. Megan, are there things on the internet that you want to draw people's attention to?
Oh, probably not.
Okay.
No, just if you're ever interested in silent comedy or reading about it, there should be some articles coming out within the next year or two. It's Cinema Journal, and if you kind of keep your eye out on just film journals and type it in on Google, Megan Boyd, you should see a lot of work on silent comedy and female comedians in particular. So if you are so willing, check it out.
Yeah, I want that Venn diagram, Pulp Fiction fans, silent film comedians. I think it might just be Megan.
Me.
There you go, and me. So
it's a Venn diagram.
Yeah.
So 100% of people polled are in this Venn diagram.
That's just a circle. There you go. All right. Okay, so yeah, look for Megan's work in academic journals in the not-so-distant future, and I think that just about wraps it up. Shall we go get some pancakes? Let's do it. Yeah.